Thank you so much for coming to the early lunch today, ladies and gentlemen. It's so kind of you to come here today. We're only here thanks to our great sponsor, Charles Stanley. So thank you so much. My name is Harry Mount, editor of the greatest magazine in the stratosphere. And I am a poor substitute for the late, great Barry Cryer, who did this job so much better than me. And we publish a weekly joke by him, which still takes up a third of our website hits. Only at the oldie will a late comedian be top of the charts. And his latest joke, which is doing very well on the website, he was always very good at recognizing his fellow comics. And he talked about an American comic called Alan King, who said, "I'm 62 and people call me middle-aged. How many 124-year-olds do you know?" We've got three terrific writers here today, and the first is one of our greatest historians. At the callow age of 24, he wrote In Xanadu and has written many best-selling histories since, including From the Holy Mountain, A Journey in the Shadow of Byzantium. And his latest book is The Golden Road, How Ancient India Transformed the World. Ladies and gentlemen, Willie Durham.
It's a great pleasure to be here. James was at college with me, and I have to say I'm very worried to see him teetotal at lunch and refuse sticky toffee pudding. It's something unheard of in the history, I'm sure, of the elderly. But he looked at the sticky toffee pudding and quaked and turned it away. So I don't know what this means for the future of this magazine, but it's a worrying moment. I thought I'd put that in there for you all before. The book I've just written, The Golden Road, is the first book I've written about India for 25 years that hasn't been about the colonial period. I've been writing about the East India Company and the Mughals and all that sort of stuff. And this is about a much, much earlier period of history, which is what actually first drew me to India, aged 18, 40 years ago. This was the wonders of ancient India. I went in 1984, went round the Ellora and Ajanta caves, the extraordinary early burial mounds in Sanchi, and fell in love with this extraordinary ancient history, but somehow ended up writing about the 18th century, and have now come back to really what was my first love. And I've had five fantastic years tracing the diffusion of Indian ideas out of India. Because India, like Greece, in a way that we're very familiar with Greece, beamed out and diffused its answers to the big questions. Why are we here? What is our purpose on earth? What should we achieve? How do we live our lives? How do we count, enumerate, and divide this world we live in? And if you grew up in this country, as I'm sure most of you did, you will know the Greek answers to those questions, and you will know the names of people like Pythagoras and Archimedes since primary school, because these were people we all learn about. But just out of interest, how many people in this room have heard of Aryabhatta or Brahmagupta? Put your hands up if any of you have heard of it. One. Aryabhatta, Brahmagupta, between them, basically came up with the idea of zero and the numbers we all use every day. Absolutely essential to modern life, to life since in Europe since the 12th century. The nearest thing the human race has to a universal language, because their answers to that question have been used in every country in the world. And yet, their stories are completely unknown to us here in the West. And this is part of a wider absence. Well, I think probably because of the attitudes of colonialism, we never learned the extraordinary things that India did. Ever since Macaulay famously said that a good shelf of English books is better than the entire native literature of India and Arabia. This stuff simply hasn't been taught in our schools. And today we love Macaulay saying that, but we don't know the Indian story. So this book tries to bring it all together in one book. It's only, there's 200 pages of notes, but it's only 300 pages of text. And it tries to gallop through India's contribution to world civilizations. And there are various different heads. The book kind of opens with something which, again, I think we're completely unaware of, that India was the Roman Empire's biggest trading partner. Pliny talks about how India was the sink of all the precious metals in the world. Strabo mentions that at one port, Maius Hormus on the Red Sea, 250 vessels left in a single fleet each year with the monsoon winds to trade with India. And recent figures that Oxford have come up with, based on something called the Musiris Papyrus, which is an extraordinary set of shipping documents taken out by an Alexandrian shipping owner in the first century AD to a supplier in Kerala. From that, they've calculated that maybe as much as one third of the entire Roman imperial budget came from the customs take of the import of Indian luxuries, pepper, ivory, various different materials for perfume, including nard, which if you remember in the Gospels, Martha, was it Mary, spears on the feet of Christ, wild animals for the circuses, cottons and silk. And this extraordinary world is completely unfamiliar to us, not least because over the last 40 years we've all been wooed with this very romantic idea of the Silk Road, which I don't believe existed at all at this period. There is a recent map produced in Oxford of Roman coin hoards, and as you can imagine, the coins all over the Mediterranean, on the North African coast, all over Europe, thinning out as they go northwards into Germany and Russia and Scotland. But there is this enormous concentration of Roman gold coins found all over India and Sri Lanka. And this is stuff which people just aren't aware of. There is not one Roman coin, however, ever been found in China, other than about, I think there's six in a tomb as a decoration. No Roman coin hoards have been found in China. So we need to kind of forget this idea at this period. The Silk Road existed by the time of Marco Polo in the 13th century after the Mongols smashed a hole through the narrow waste of Asia, linking the Mediterranean with the South China Sea. But in the Roman period, it was India that was the focus of Roman trade and Indian luxuries that Pliny, who is a sort of familiar sort of Harumphy naval commander that you could meet in one of Patrick's books today, who can't see why Roman women want to wear silk or smear this horrible, pungent new substance called pepper all over their food. And this is a trade that goes both ways. We've recently started finding a great deal of Buddhist material in Egypt, raising the question whether Buddhist monasticism, which exists three centuries before Christian monasticism, could have been an influence on St. Anthony and the early Desert Fathers in Egypt. Equally, you have Buddhist missions setting off and first taking over Central Asia and Afghanistan, and then travelling over to China. And Buddhism is an Indian religion. The Buddha, who came up with an idea of how you end suffering in the 5th century BC, his ideas spread slowly around North India for a couple of hundred years, and then they ricochet around the world when the Emperor Ashoka makes it the state religion in India. He sends missionaries as far as Cyrene, which is modern Libya, but also all over India to Sri Lanka, and then Sri Lanka itself becomes another base of Buddhism. And you find Buddhism, this set of Indian religious ideas, becoming increasingly popular, not just in India and Central Asia, but increasingly in China itself. And then this extraordinary woman, Wu Zetian, makes it the state religion in China. Wu Zetian is a fifth ranking concubine in the emperor's bedroom. When the old emperor dies, he somehow manages to cling on to the crown prince, and so is rescued from the monastery, or nunnery, into which all the concubines and empresses are put, the emperor's death. Becomes the empress herself, having first framed the previous empress and had her murdered. Within a few years, her husband, the new emperor, has mysteriously died from strange illness, and she becomes the only woman emperor in her own right in 3,000 years of Chinese domestic history. And what she does to back her up against the Confucians, who don't like women taking over, is she converts China to Buddhism. So very briefly, you have this moment when China takes on an Indian religion as the state faith. And with that comes Indian astrologers, Indian astronomers, and particularly graduates of the great ancient Indian University of Nalanda, which was the main, like what the Library of Alexandria was to the Mediterranean world, Nalanda was to Asia. It has colleges set up by different countries across Asia at this place in Bihar, in central India. And it's the Oxford, the Ivy League, the NASA of its day, to which students come from hundreds of miles away. At the same time, Hinduism and Hindu ideas are spreading through Southeast Asia, so that the largest temple in the world, the largest Hindu temple in the world, is built not in India, but in Cambodia, at Angkor Wat. And again, this whole story is one that we're very, very unfamiliar with. The civilization of Angkor, the Khmer Empire, there was 1 million citizens living in Greater Angkor when London had 20,000 people. It was this vast Hindu empire which stretches across the whole of modern Southeast Asia. But ironically, while Southeast Asia has now become 8 or 9 different kingdoms, Laos, Vietnam, Thailand, Malaysia, and so on, India, which was 70 kingdoms at that time, is now one united country. Possibly, you could say, thanks to Lord Curzon and Robert Clive. So India, we now think of as a united place, when in fact it was, for most of its history, fractured. Which is why in India, the place that dreamt up the big Buddhist and Hindu ideas, the temples are relatively small, while when you go to Angkor Wat, the area within the outer moat is alone 4 times the size of the Vatican City. It is the largest religious monument on earth. And it is in a very Indian style. But what's interesting is that India is like, if you like, the garden that produces astonishing seeds, which, when planted elsewhere, grow in strange ways. And the Buddhism of Java and Hinduism of Southeast Asia is very different from the Hinduism of India. For example, there's no caste. People eat pork. There are women Brahmins. So all this is very, very strange and interesting. But the way India affected us, in a way that we don't know, is the numbers we use every day. They were dreamt up in India in the first century. The Emperor Ashoka makes them in use across the whole of India. And then in the 7th century, a series of Buddhist abbots who converted to Islam bring them into Baghdad. And it becomes the Arab system. We borrow it from the Arabs, so we call them Arabic numbers. But they are not. In origin, they are Indian. And the person who brings them from the Arab world to Italy is the mathematician Fibonacci, who happened to be brought up as an expat kid in Algeria, and just at the local primary school, learns these new numbers, which are in use by that stage all over the Arab world. While in Europe, people are still trying to do multiplication by MCVV1X times CVMMMV. And Fibonacci arrives back home aged 18 to find his contemporaries struggling with all this and writes a book called the Liber Abaci, the book of calculation and balancing by the Hindu method. And he says how the Hindus have developed this extraordinary technique with only 9 numbers and the symbol 0. All completely new in the West at that point. It's taken up by the Emperor Frederick II, and from there it spreads out. Piero della Francesca, who we all think of as the greatest of the Renaissance painters, is renowned at the time as primarily a mathematician, and his ideas and perspective were all developed from reading Fibonacci's version of these Indian mathematical techniques. And he writes 3 mathematical treatises, which are then plagiarized by a friar called Friar Caroli, And it's these that give birth to the Italian banking revolution that produces the Medici, double counting, and in time, you could argue, the rise of the West. So you can at least make an argument that it is the economic weight of the West, after they've learned Indian numbers and Indian accounting and Indian banking and Indian interest rates, that creates the sort of corporation like the East India Company, which then goes back and conquers India in a very unfortunate vicious circle if you're Indian, but to the enormous enrichment of this country. So this book tells the story of the forgotten contribution of India to all our lives. It's one of the foundations of our world, but we have forgotten it. Thank you.
Our next speaker is one of our leading journalists and writers. She's had the questionable privilege of sharing a desk with Boris Johnson in Brussels, and her first book was indeed just Boris, A Tale of Blonde Ambition. She then wrote a biography of Clementine Churchill, Winston Churchill's wife, First Lady, and her latest book is Kingmaker, Pamela Churchill Harriman's Astonishing Life of Seduction, Intrigue, and Power. Ladies and gentlemen, Sonia Pennell.
Thank you all indeed for coming today. This is the first time I've spoken about Kingmaker in public, so I'm afraid this time I do have notes, forgive me. And also, I'm going to talk about a rather more earthy subject than we heard about just now. If you know anything about Pamela Harriman, you might know what I mean. In fact, her full names were Pamela Digby Churchill Hayward Harriman, and despite this marvellous name, she is barely known today. And if any of you do know her, as I say, it's probably because you think of her as an epic shagger, which she was. But there's more to it than that. Interestingly, photographs don't always do her justice. I did find a few for the book that give you some idea as to her powers, but it's much more complicated than that. She wasn't ever a classic beauty, and people, including Barbara Streisand, was obsessed. Well, how did she manage to be such a seductress? And she sidled up to her once at an event at the White House to ask her that very question. I'm afraid I don't know what Pamela said in response, but I do know that when Pamela was around in the 20th century, she was born in 1920, to have power in your life, you couldn't acquire it yourself. You had to acquire a powerful man, and that's what she was really, really good at. And how do you acquire a powerful man? You make the powerful man feel like a king, and she was even better at that. And how she did it, a few little tips. She flattered and fawned, and she practiced something called her mating dance, which was looking at someone intently with her sapphire eyes, smiling with her tongue pointed erotically just behind her teeth, and then doing a streaky, streaky thing on the forearm. Apparently it worked every time. She also learned, just to think, I know this is only lunchtime, but forgive me, I'm not going to tell you everything, but if you want to know everything by the book, believe me, it's in there, but I'll just tell you a little bit. She also learned exceptional sexual techniques from Ali Khan. Some of you may have heard of him. And why did Ali Khan know these sexual techniques? Because, amazingly, his father sent him as a teenager to a doctor in Cairo who gave him a six-week intensive course in what you do in bed. So she passed it on, he passed it on to her, and I managed to speak to a couple of the lucky men who were beneficiaries of this. As I say, there is quite a lot of detail in the book. But I'm not even going to tell you which page it's on. But the fact is that she wasn't just an epic shagger or a great seductress. She also educated herself in statecraft. And she became just as fluent in things like UN Security Council resolutions or the Panama Treaty or arms reduction treaties as she did in what to do in bed. And yet this was a woman who in her youth could neither spell nor add up, who never went to a school apart from a year at a sort of academy where she learned domestic science, which apparently is the posh name for cooking and sewing. Not that she ever did either, by the way, but you know, she did know how to do them.
She was, in fact, a woman once described by Kick Kennedy to her brother Jack as a stupid, fat butterball. But the stupid, fat butterball turned out to be so good at listening and absorbing things that she became an indispensable counsel to Winston Churchill, her father-in-law, briefly, in the 1940s, Gianni Agnelli of Fiat in the 1950s, JFK himself in the 1960s, and then out of the Democratic Party until she helped Bill Clinton, in his own words, reach the White House. He said, he told me he couldn't have done it without her. So we're talking about an immense life, not just in an erotic way, but in a political sense, over 50 years, imagine that. And three countries, as also France comes into this, and two continents. In fact, President Biden stepping down at the end of this year marks the end of her political influence, finally, because he too was one of her protégés. It's remarkable, really. So I've decided, or I've come to view her in the terms of a Martin Spencer's ad, which I know you'll think is a bit strange, but just bear with me and you'll see what I mean. So, she didn't just marry Churchill's son and live at Downing Street from the age of 19. She became, as I said, the great man's invaluable confidant as he waged the World War. She helped drag America into that conflict to save Britain and the world from tyranny. She cheered him up when he was down and acted as sounding board at all his most challenging moments, whether that was the invasion of Sicily or D-Day or plenty of others. Pamela didn't just live through the Blitz. She was often at the centre of its fury and destruction, narrowly missed death several times, and even gave birth during an air raid at Chequers, with bombs crashing all around. Randolph, her husband and the father of the baby, was meanwhile elsewhere engaged, i.e. in the arms of another woman who couldn't be found. He was a bit of a bad, and as you'll also find out in the book. She didn't just know everything about the conduct of the war from her privileged position as Prime Ministerial Counsel and friend of the American military. She kept secrets and juggled information vital to victory, and crucially, she helped to smooth out spats between the Brits and the Americans, and there were plenty, not least on bombing campaigns. The Brits wanted to bomb at night, safer for air crews, this was Germany obviously. The Americans thought there were too many civilian casualties, wanted to bomb during the day. It was a major, major row, and she was dispatched by Churchill to try and find a compromise, and certainly one was found. So on Churchill's account, she didn't just seduce the most important Americans visiting London, Admiral Harriman, many generals and so on, woo them round to the British cause when they went back to Washington, they were all accused of having been bewitched, and extract vital intelligence from them during pillow talk. She helped to create, elevate and sustain the thing that we now call the special relationship. It didn't exist back then. And where did she do it? Well, she lived mostly between the sheets of the Dorchester Hotel. She didn't just know General Eisenhower, she didn't go to bed with him, by the way. She talked battle strategies with him, though, often invited him to intimate dinners in her apartment in Grosvenor Square, and in return, he did her washing up. She didn't just know Ed Murrow, the CBS correspondent. He fell for her as the great passion of his life, and she helped him sustain the British line with his famous forecast from London. You know, this is London. Very often, very, very pro-bit British. You would feed them lots of vital info. So virtually every general, every wartime leader was entranced by her, from FDR back in Washington, the notoriously prickly Charles de Gaulle, who was absolutely bewitched by her, and her fame even reached Stalin and Kremlin, also equally obsessed with her. After the war, she didn't just know Gianni Agnelli, she was with him for 4 years and helped him rescue Fiat and thereby the Italian economy after the war, and rehabilitate himself from the shame of having fought for the fascists. I mean, Fiat was very, very nearly taken off the Agnellis by the Americans after the war, and she was very much instrumental in him being able to keep it. She transformed him into an industrial king, able to operate on an equal world leaders. In gratitude, he called her every day for the rest of her life at 7 a.m. every single day, bought her a very swanky apartment in Brussels, a custom-made Bentley, a butler, and out of all the couturiers, which did quite well at that. She didn't just know Frank Sinatra, he proposed her and flew her around on his plane. She didn't just have an affair with the notorious cold fish Elie de Rothschild. He fell for her and wanted to give it all up until she bailed on him. She didn't just marry a Broadway king. He was the one who brought us The Sound of Music, Leland Haywood. She didn't just fervently believe, on a more serious note, in finding a way to bring the Cold War to an end through opening new talks. She took part and was the lead speaker in a historic meeting with Andropov in the Kremlin in 1983 that planted the seeds of the great 1980s rapprochement between Washington and Moscow. Maybe we could do with someone like Pamela now. She started off disliking feminism, many people did, even women of her generation. She didn't just become a convert, but she became a champion of women in public life and the first female American ambassador to Paris. There have only been two even now, and I met the most recent one last week. Sorry, I'm on the third one now. There were two after that. Incidentally, she was so unusual that no one quite knew whether to call her Madame l'Ambassadeur or Madame l'Ambassadrice. Only Madame l'Ambassadrice made her sound like the wife of the ambassador, so she was very, very strict. She would be Madame l'Ambassadeur. And finally, she didn't just get into American politics, she rescued the Democratic Party after its wipeout to Reagan in 1980. And by, as I said, Clinton's own account, got him into the White House 12 years later, ending the party's long losing streak. She promoted him, she counseled him, she told him about international statecraft. After all, she learnt it from Churchill. She really made a difference to his life. Oh, and by the way, she also helped young Senator Joe Biden weather his storms, telling him that the 1988 row over plagiarism when he went for presidency at that point was just a wrinkle in his career, and in the long term he would come back. Well, she was right about that. She even helped Nelson Mandela in his first multiracial elections in South Africa. No one knows about the stuff. This is all in her private papers. It was kind of completely hidden from public view. And she didn't just become an ambassador to France. As I said, she was a unique go-between between Clinton and Chirac during the Bosnia War. Both sides claimed that it would have been almost impossible to have the alliance that they had in order to bring that conflict to an end without the understanding that she had of both of them. She was a brilliant go-between that made, again, each man feel like a king, each man feel like they were getting their own way, but she somehow came out with them. An agreement that pleased them both. She believed, by the way, utterly in the global leadership of the United States and worked jolly hard to sustain it. Chirac compared her to Franklin and Jefferson in her diplomatic powers when she died. And one last thing, her life ran the gamut of the most intense emotions. Excitement, she had plenty of that. Anxiety, also plenty of that. Fear, ambition, love, jealousy, betrayal, some would say greed, certainly heartache, illness, but ultimately loneliness, a true killer. Sometimes when you have a life as exceptional as that, and you make a splash in the way that she did, you find yourself at the end on your own. You see, she didn't just have enemies, ambitious people often do. She had people, quite a few people, who loathed her and who wanted to destroy her and who actually trashed her reputation, something that I've been trying to sort of, you know, overturn just a little, because it turns out she wasn't at all the woman that people used to think she was. And on that point, actually, those who worked closely with her, her admirers often, she had people, they didn't just admire her, they thought she was a one-off in history. They were right. And whether you were a world leader, a general, a diplomat, a lover, or even an enemy, she was unforgettable. And yet, as I said, like so many astonishing women, history has buried her or misunderstood her worth. I think Kamala Harris, in the position that she is now, has a lot to, you know, to thank Pamela Harriman for. I know that Hillary Clinton did, they were quite close. And I'm just hoping that I can change her reputation for a wider audience. Thanks very much, Miss.
Our last speaker is one of our leading foreign correspondents and writers. He spent 25 years as a foreign correspondent in conflicts around the world, and his books include books about the Royal Air Force during World War II, Fighter Boys and Bomber Boys, Three Para, the British deployment to Afghanistan, The Man Who Was Saturday, about Mary Neave, and his latest book, which just come out to chime with the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Paris, is Paris 44, The Shame and the Glory. Ladies and gentlemen, Patrick Bishop.
Paper. I see Willie didn't use any notes at all. Sonia used a phone. I'm old school, so you're going to have to bear with me as I turn the pages. On the subject of Pamela Harriman, when I was based in Paris for the Telegraph, I was flush enough to join the Ritz Health Club, and I used to go down and swim in the morning in the Ritz, and there, Pamela Harriman, we sort of doing her lengths up and down alongside me. I felt very privileged. Even at that, she must have been getting on a bit then. And she still certainly had some allure. And indeed, she died in that very, or had a fatal heart attack, I believe, or embolism or something in that very pool. That's just by the way. Like Willie, I'm going to ask you a question. Is there anybody here who doesn't like Paris, who doesn't like the city of Paris? No one. What a surprise. But it's amazing, isn't it? I mean, after all these years, after all the competition that Paris now gets from other cities, it's still got a place in our hearts. And I think, like Paris, you're going to like this book. So it's about many things. It's about liberation. But to understand the liberation, you have to understand the years that went before. And so a lot of it is about French society, French politics, done, I hope, in as entertaining a way as possible. So it's about resistors, about collaborators, about heroism, about cowardice, and as the subtitle says, the shame and the glory of that liberation story of those incredible days, just about 80 years ago. But at the core of this story is, of course, the city itself. And I've lived there at various times over my life, I think for a total of about 8 or 9 years, and I know it pretty well, warts and all, and there are, as anyone who knows Paris, it's not without its flaws. But nonetheless, I remain a fan. And I think, I was living there with my family from 2016 onwards for 4 years. But every morning, when we had this rather fancy apartment in the 8th arrondissement, and every morning when I walked out of those heavy porte-cochere doors into the street, I felt the same kind of buzz as when I first went there all those years ago when I was lad of 17, hitchhiked there with a mate. We got the boat train to Calais, and I can remember the boat pulling into Calais. It was like those old Jean Gabin black and white movies of the 1930s. I remember seeing the Pelleforth beer sign, illuminated beer sign, shining on the cobblestones. It was a wet evening, and feeling that kind of that sense of, you know, adventure and sort of otherness, I suppose. And the smell, the first thing that used to hit me then was the smell. It was a kind of mixture of Gauloises, Caporal tobacco, and drains, and that's gone. anyway, I mean, the time we spent in Paris was very light on culture, but a lot of hanging around in bars, trying to talk in our schoolboy French to the girls we came across, with zero success, I have to say. But it started off in a sort of strange circumstance. We hitched and we arrived in Paris at nightfall. And as we dotted down by the side of the river, we saw what we thought was the Eiffel Tower in the distance. So we thought, great, this is it, we're here. And then when dawn broke, we saw in fact it was an electricity pylon. So, I mean, Paris was London in those days, it's not that long ago, so that, what are we talking about here? About 1970, I suppose. London still had bomb sites in those days, big sort of gaping holes in the townscape where the Luftwaffe bombs had dropped. But Paris was still remarkably intact, and you didn't really get any sense of the war there. But bit by bit, I noticed these little plaques set in the wall. Everyone has seen them, I'm sure, on their trips to Paris, these little marble, well, discreet marble monuments, which say, ici est tombé so-and-so, a man, or sometimes a woman, often very young, mort pour la France. And so that sort of gave me an idea of the drama of the liberation. And the liberation really was a big, big thing. And when you think about it, Paris held this, because Paris held this special place in the world's imagination, the fate of other big European cities, Warsaw, Amsterdam, they didn't mean as much as the fate of Paris. So when Paris fell, without a shot being fired, it must be said, the behaviour of the French army is one of the elements of shame that I write about in the book. Half the world, the free world, mourned, because Paris wasn't just a place, it was an idea as much as anything. It was associated with pleasure, with creativity, with art, but also with tolerance, with love. And these were all the things the Nazis wanted to smash to pieces. So when it was freed again, it was as if a light had been switched on again. And suddenly it looked like the nightmare that people, everyone had been living through for the previous 4 or 5 years, created by Hitler, was almost over. And people could start to think about the future, thinking about a good future where they could live their lives again, pick up the pieces of the old ones. So Paris was, of course, very much a city of spectacle, so that the business of the liberation was an immensely powerful scene. And I'm just going to read out a little reportage by the famous American war reporter, Ernie Pyle, who was there that day. And he wrote that it was a pandemonium of surely the greatest mass joy that has ever happened. We all got kissed until we were literally red in the face. I must say we enjoyed it. When the Jeep was simply swamped in human traffic and had to stop, we were swarmed over and hugged and kissed and torn at. Everybody, even beautiful girls, insisted on kissing you on both cheeks. The fact that I hadn't shaved for days and was grey-bearded as well as bald-headed made no difference. Now, incidentally, Pyle was greatly admired by Ernest Hemingway, who, of course, was also a war correspondent. He was there, and he features quite a bit in my story. And Hemingway sometimes used to introduce himself as saying, "Hi, I'm Ernie Hemeroid, the poor man's Pyle." Another description was supplied by J.D. Salinger, who was a young aspiring writer, but he arrived by Jeep with the 4th Infantry Division, where he was serving as a sergeant of the counterintelligence unit. Now, he wrote back to a friend in New York that the crowds cried, they laughed, they besieged us, they brought bottles of cognac out to the Jeep. It was really fine. There was still shooting in the streets, but nobody seemed to care. All the girls looked elegant and had put on their best August dresses. He felt that if we had stood on the hood of the Jeep and taken a leak, Paris would have said, "Ah, the charming Americans, what a charming customer." So I wondered during the research what effect all this had on the birth rate, and I dug around in the records. Sure enough, 9 months later, it had jumped, and in one arrondissement, it had more than doubled. So there are lots of famous names in the story who all came together on those heady days, like Hemingway, Salinger, Picasso, but lots of more obscure but equally fascinating characters who represent all sides of the story: German and French collaborator, resistant, etc., ordinary folk you never have heard of, but who actually had very interesting wars. But as well as making babies, lots of myths were created that day. Most famous of all, the idea that Paris had liberated itself. Now, this was the work of Charles de Gaulle, who I was interested in. He was also smitten by Pamela Harriman. That must have been quite a feat, actually, to impress de Gaulle. But he seized this moment to establish himself as the leader of the new France, in effect by acclamation, as he walked down the Champs-Élysées. This is the day after the actual liberation, this is the 26th, the Saturday, to the really hysterical cheers of crowds who until that moment had very little idea of what he looked like. And to most of them, he was just a voice on the radio. Got to remember that France was already a very bitterly divided country. And as a result of the defeat, this catastrophic defeat, and the humiliation of the occupation, these divisions just got worse. And it was entirely possible, I think, that the liberation might actually have ushered in a civil war between the diehards of the collaborationist Vichy regime and the forces of Free France, represented and headed by de Gaulle. So this first speech, this first utterance that he made to the nation was of incredible importance. So he made it in the Hotel de Ville, Paris City Hall, and he declared that Paris had been outraged, broken, martyred, but now it was liberated. And he went on, it was liberated by itself, liberated by its people, with the help of the armies of France, with the help and assistance of the whole of France. He went on in this way. But of course, it was all nonsense. The armies of France, in this case, amounted to one armoured division, the Deuxième Blindée, commanded by Philippe Leclerc. But although the Brits were pretty annoyed about this, I can see entirely the necessity for this. This was a lie that had to be told to make Paris and France generally feel good about itself and plaster over the very deep cracks in society. And it worked. France went on to prosperity and arguably an undeserved place on the world stage. It's an extraordinary thing that the French, having a joking brilliant Allied victory, then had a place on the Security Council, etc., etc. But you only have to look at France now to see that it remains a disjointed, I suppose, one way of putting it, a disjointed nation, a disjointed society. When I look at Marine Le Pen's National Rally, the vibe that I get from that has a very strong whiff of Vichy about it. And when I look at Emmanuel Macron, I think dear old Emmanuel definitely fancies himself as a reincarnation of Charles de Gaulle. But having said that, the French have done a lot to come to terms with this painful passage in their history. I was talking about this with Harry earlier. We've got to give them credit for that. Naturally, these things take time, but over the years, they really have taken a pretty stern look at themselves and their conduct during that period. But it does still remain a touchy subject, which they understandably feel a little uncomfortable, but an outsider like myself starts to rake over it. So, on the history of the book today, Paris 44, The Shame and the Glory. It's been published in Canada, the US, rights have been sold in Italy and elsewhere. But so far, not a sniff from a French publisher. But my wife suggested a solution. She said, it might be wiser if the author of the title went on. And she said, how about this career, Paris 44, The Glory? That might get some takers. Thank you very much indeed.